If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. On these podcasts, we talk to guests who have experienced harm from extreme religious beliefs, as well as experts who offer help, hope, and healing. And sometimes these people are one and the same. I am your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett. Our goal is to release a new episode every other week where we interview guests about their story of religious involvement, and these are often recorded months in advance. From time to time, we want to drop in with a quickie pod, and that's where we talk about topics that are current and relevant, and these are not necessarily scheduled, but we just want to bring everything up to date. And this is going to be our very first quickie pod. And we want to, in this quickie pod, talk about the movie Boy Erased, which is one man's experience with conversion therapy. Since Bill and I both have strong religious backgrounds that include being involved in this type of program, we really wanted to share our thoughts about the film and the message. And I just want to add that we have not talked before this. We both saw the film yesterday, and both of us are a little bit raw. So this episode is really going to be discussing what we saw, how we felt, and the overall conversation about conversion therapy.
Boy Erased is a movie that's based on a book. The book is a memoir by Garrett Conley. He wrote this memoir about his time in Love in Action, and it's first person, his story. Then the book was optioned, and they decided to make a movie. And in making the movie, they did a fictionalized version. It is still called Boy Erased, but the names have been changed, and it's kind of the same story. But for movies, they sometimes do that. So it's not considered a memoir movie, an autobiographical movie, but it is based on a memoir. So that's kind of the background. I will tell you that one of the characters in the movie, the leader of the conversion therapy organization, Tim and I both know the person that character is based on. In fact, he's one of my dearest friends. And so I don't claim total objectivity in that. I did a claim total objectivity when the book came out and I read excerpts from it. So that kind of factored in when I was seeing it. And I think that because, Tim, you were actually on staff with the organization that is depicted in the movie, I kind of want to start with you because I thought it was very interesting that they took the book, which was a memoir, and the book used actual names and actual people and the name of the organization, which is Love in Action. The movie decided to change all the names except for the organization, so they kept Love in Action. Although I'm told that Love in Action doesn't actually have a refuge program, which is what they continue to refer to in the movie, but maybe you can speak to that. But since you were on staff and you were part of Love in Action, I kind of wanted you to start off with your observation.
I have to say, Bill, I was not expecting to feel what I felt. In fact, when I went to the film, I was keeping notes on my phone, you know, just to irritate the people around me.
You did not do that.
I did do that.
You are that person.
Well, I couldn't bring my laptop in.
Well, I took in, I'm going to tell you, being the obsessive compulsive that I am, and it drove my husband crazy, I took in a pad and paper. My journalism background. So during the movie, right, I made notes using a pen and paper.
I hope you wore your press pass at the same time. It was surreal. I have to say, I watched the movie. I'm taking notes, and you know, there were a couple of things that hit me really hard in the movie. But at the end of it, I was with a friend of mine, along with my husband and his niece. And at the end of the movie, she asked a question, and I started to answer the question, and I absolutely broke down sobbing because it was so surreal sitting in this theater all these years later, where I just had this flashback, you know, in the 1990s, we were traveling, we were doing all these things with media, and we felt like we were doing something for God. We felt so empowered by our message. And now, nearly 30 years later, I'm sitting in this movie theater where they're talking about love in action, and it's the exact opposite of, you know, the storyline that we tried to put out there. But what we did was horrendous. Now, and let me clarify that too, because I know when people see the film, without giving anything away, there was no abuse at Love in Action in the sense that there was no beating anyone over the head with the Bible. There was, you know, there was no yelling and screaming. That wasn't, that just wasn't part of what we did. And the depictions of our leader, you know, they brought in a lot of aspects that do happen in conversion therapy. That just wasn't what happened at Love in Action.
And I think that's what they did. They just kind of pulled in a lot of things and compressed it into a smaller time frame, a 2-hour time frame. Boy Erased, the memoir, the book, was written by a conversion therapy survivor. And I think that's one of the things that whatever issues I've had with the book and with the movie, I do appreciate that it was written by a survivor. Now, the movie was written by, the screenplay was written by, the movie was directed by, and one of the stars of the movie, same person, is a straight man. So I think there was kind of some dramatization, fictionalization in there, dramatic license, we call it.
The ministry had changed. I mean, I left in 97, and the ministry had changed dramatically in that we didn't have the year-long program that we used to have. One thing that did happen, though, is that Love in Action changed the model to an ADIC, kind of like a 12-step ADICS program, which was the next best thing. You know, back then we were working with an organization that did drug and alcohol rehabilitation for youth, and so the ministry took on some of those objectives, some of the things that they were doing for youth, because then there was the new thought, you know, if we can't do this from Bible reading and prayer, then that maybe we can do this through psychology. So we had a psychologist that was known, that was respected, and we then based this program on that on psychology, thinking, okay, well, now we're legit. Now we can say, oh, we're doing this correctly, so to speak. But it lost the relational aspect that it used to have. So it, you know, for me personally, having gone through the program in 1990, for whatever the program was, I had relationships. I had relationships with the founder and director at the time. I had relationships with, you know, with John. And I felt like we lost that at some point. So the program that we're now seeing in the movie was an extreme version of a kind of a 12 step. So I know they didn't do the year live-in program anymore, that it became a 3-month program, and then people could opt in for a 30-day or 2-week. So Jared in the movie was the 2-week program. So he was there for less than 2 weeks.
Less than 2 weeks. And I do think that the things that you see them doing, I know that we did in the ex-gay program that I was part of, we did accountability, we did moral inventories. We didn't call them that specifically, but we were encouraged to take stock of our lives and talk about the things that are our weaknesses, what are the things that trip us up. Those were part of our program as well. So I saw that in the movie. And I totally identified with it. As we were sitting through the movie, your phone may have annoyed people. I think my husband might have, because every so often he'd lean over and say, "Did that really happen? Do they do stuff like that?" And so, the exorcism scene, which was very intense and very hard to watch. And again, our goal here, and Tim and I have talked about this, just briefly setting this up, we don't want to do spoilers. We don't want to give anything away. We just want to talk about the movie and talk about our perception of it. But I've never witnessed an exorcism service that was not part of our theological foundation, but I do know it happens. I do know that I've talked with people in the 30 years since I've been out who have been through that kind of thing. I've seen videos of it actually happening. So we didn't do that. But a lot of the other things, the talking to the empty chairs and those kinds of elements were part of what were standard when I was and I was in it a lot longer ago than you were.
There were some staples that we had, the fake it till you make it. I remember hearing that from Anita Worthen, who was the, you know, one of the founder, or not founder, but she was married to Frank, who was one of the founders of Love and Action.
Yes,
and that
yes.
was something that she said to me when we talked about marriage. She's like, oh, you just have to fake it till you make it. You know, as long as you keep faking it, eventually it's all going to come together in your marriage. And of course, that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most poignant scenes for me, which could have just been, you know, kind of passing by, was he made a statement about Job. I feel like God is,
yes,
is, you know, toying with me, or whatever his yeah. statement was. I started to lose it at that point, because mm-hmm. that was so raw for me, thinking
right.
in all of those years, I just kept thinking, I can do this. And then you think, what is going on? Why are things not changing? Or mm-hmm. why do I have these feelings of suicide? And I'm just pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and climbing uphill and pushing a boulder uphill. And it feels like, does God love me? Is God toying with me? Why is this happening to me?
Well, and it's interesting, because that particular scene, I had seen a clip of that prior to seeing the movie, and it had impacted me as well. The whole idea, he said, he's talking to another young man, and he says, do you know Job? And the young man says, not personally. Right. And he says, he said, I see that as kind of my life, God and the devil. And he said, I hope that one day the God and the devil will tell me, let me know about this experiment that's going on to test me. And I thought that was so incredibly a picture of what we were pretty much taught. It was sometimes it's all that this is God testing us. Sometimes it's all the devil that is doing this to us. It's our old sin nature. We have to fight against this part that we're feeling. And it's always this duality and this conflict going on inside us or outside of us, God and the devil and our inner nature, our sinful nature. It's all so conflict oriented. And one of the things that I think I realized toward the end of my time in the ministry was, if it's about my old sin nature and victory is walking where my new nature is stronger than my old nature, then at best, my life can always be seen as a standoff. I'm never going to overcome this old sin nature, because it's a part of me that I can just hold it off enough that the spirit-filled nature in me manifests. And so that's always, that always struck me as, I'm never really going to be free of this.
And that's the whole idea of the separating the sin from the sinner, is that when your whole life is seen as a sin,
mm-hmm.
you can't separate the two things. I mean, I think that's why a lot of us who go through ex-gay ministry or conversion therapy, we do become two people. We turn into two people, because you can't take the sexuality out of a human being. It's just part of who we are. But we start to create two different boxes where you have, you know, your Christian life, where you just so strongly want to integrate those two things, but it's just not going to happen. So mm-hmm. what other option? And of course, you're going to feel like shit. You're a sinner. There's no redemption for someone whose sin is intertwined with who they are as a human being.
Yeah. So I end up hating part of me always, and I'm never going to be able to embrace that part of me. And this whole idea of fake it till you make it, or as we were always told, say what you want, not what you feel, this name it and claim it concept. I think that was, there were two really powerful images in the movie. You had one young man who kept saying, fake it till you make it. And so he wouldn't touch anybody. And he, you know, he was faking it till he made it, as a way of eventually realizing it. And then you had another young man who says, you have to learn to play the game. You fake it because that's how you make it. And so it was totally two different interpretations of that idea. And I was fascinated by that.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that really caught me, well, there were several things that really kind of caught me on this movie.
Yes.
But why do families go to ex-gay ministries in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And watching that family in the film was another one of those situations where they don't know what to do when
yes.
you've been raised with such strong dogmatic beliefs. You have to go to extremes in order to make those beliefs a reality. And I thought of something that my dad always said is that you can be sincere, but you can be sincerely wrong.
Yes, yes.
And that was the kind of jumped out at the movie for me, is that here were people that were so sincere. Now it turns into your sincerity becomes an abuse. Mm-hmm. And I would say that is probably the underlying core of most conversion therapy organizations, is that they're usually sincere. The people that are in there are sincere.
Yes.
But they are sincerely wrong.
And I appreciate that the movie did not, for the most part, didn't present the people in there as villains, as monsters. So often, one of the pet peeves that I have, I never support conversion therapy. I don't ever want to sound like I am, but I see conversion therapy depicted in movies and TV, and it tends to be stereotypical or caricatures. In the original Will and Grace, they did an episode on that, and it was just so out there. On the Showtime series Queer as Folk, they did a half a season, I think, on this whole thing, and it was just so ridiculous the way they presented it. And so I did kind of appreciate that the people in the movie, the leader, he was not a horrible, evil man. He was sincerely caught up in it himself. I think the parents, I, in fact, one of the things I wrote down as I was watching is the movie is the story of this one young man, but it's also the story of his parents. And it's a good story for parents to see. If you have LGBTQ kids, see this movie, because it's a story of how parents deal with it, because there was their pain, their fear, their embarrassment, their confusion, all of that figured into this story.
It's very easy to find the antagonist. It's very easy to point to that conversion therapy leader or that organization and say, that's the antagonist, that's the problem. But it doesn't deal with the underlying problems that got them there.
Yes.
And if you take out that one conversion therapy leader, he repents or he, you know, goes and has gay sex, whatever it is, he's gone. There's 100 more behind him that are ready to take his place, mm-hmm. because we're not talking about the root problem of that issue, which is the ideology of fundamentalist religious faith.
Yes. Fundamentalism is the problem.
That.
Yes.
We've got to address it. We've got to, I mean, not to excuse it. I'm not excusing anybody or any, you know, anything that we had done when we were in the organization, but we're driven by these beliefs and we're driven by dogmatism and we're driven by ideologies that simply are not true. They're anti-human, mm-hmm. but we're not addressing the problem. And this is a problem that goes into the fabric of American society. These people are in politics. These people are currently running the government, and they're making decisions based on these ideologies that are just as anti-human. And we're not talking about that. We're just talking about the surface issues.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, I saw a couple of interviews on talk shows with some of the stars of the movie. And, you know, they were very open about, you know, this many states still allow conversion therapy. Only so many states have prevented it, and we need to do more. And I do appreciate that. And I've been asked by reporters about the idea of outlawing conversion therapy for children. But that's not going to solve our problem, because that still doesn't do anything for the churches that promote it, the churches that instill it, the churches that raise up the people who lead these groups, because they're not going to be. Can you hear that in the background?
I can, yes.
Okay. All of a sudden, my printer decided it needed to clean its printer heads. So since we are live and we are just going at it, I'm just going to acknowledge the noise in the background. So anyway, I've told people that, yes, I'm in favor of outlawing it for mental health professionals. I think it should be. I think they should have their credentials pulled if they do it. But the reality is that's not going to stop conversion therapy.
No, it's not going to stop conversion therapy. And at one point I would have said, you know what, let churches be churches, let them do their thing. We don't want to interrupt whatever it is that they have faith going on. But I've changed my position on that. I think we have to look at what damage is being done. And I realize that this has probably gone on, well, it has gone on for centuries since we've had religion. But In a democratic, pluralistic society, how far are we willing to put up with any belief that is anti-human in nature and that denies someone their own human experience, and worse, is psychologically damaging? It's something that I know in the Joni case in New Jersey, where they went to court for fraud. That's what I think we need to be talking about: is this is fraud. It's damaging to our youth. It's damaging to the men and women who go in as adults and try to get some kind of conversion therapy. But there has to be a comprehensive education program about this. We need to have a comprehensive discussion about this. We need to look at the psychological factors. We need to talk about the religious factors. We need to look at why people went there, right? So, I mean, when you and I went into conversion therapy, we went in as adults believing and thinking that this was going to change us.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but there's nothing that would have stopped me at that point, because the only thing I could think of was, I have to get rid of this. In order for me to be a Christian and godly, I have to get rid of this problem in my life.
Well, and I think that it goes back to what you said earlier, that it's the root problem. The reason you and I went in is because we were taught that everything we were feeling was sinful, that we were an abomination, that we were the problem. And so we had this idea that we had to fix it, because otherwise, I mean, we could not be a Christian. So it's the underlying. And I'm not in any way opposed to states enacting legislation. I think every time a state enacts legislation that outlaws this, then maybe another parent will have a second thought about it. If somebody suggests they send their kid to some kind of church sponsored program, maybe they'll have a second thought about it. But maybe it's time to start bringing lawsuits against some of these churches and some of these church sponsors and groups. This is a systemic problem, but it's a serious problem. I mean, at the end of the movie, they put up a statistic that 700,000 young people have undergone conversion therapy through some kind of program. Well, that's ridiculous.
Well, sadly, and another point the movie brought out was that you have a parent who now has to make a choice between their church and their child. And I've seen this over and over again. People that I've talked to, I know that there's a wonderful group out there that helps parents face this. And at one point, and I know you and I had been on that same chat room with some of these parents, and I heard stories of, my child came out as LGBT and I had to make a choice. My pastor said we could stay, but we had to deal with their homosexuality, or they lost their community. They had to choose between the church and their child. And it's horribly sad, you know. And I think the mother in the story, there is that gut feeling. As a parent, there is a gut feeling that something's not quite right. You do want what's best for your kid, but there are still those times when those dogmas or ideologies or just plain fear of hell keeps you from making the right decision.
Well, and there is a scene, and I'm not spoiling because it's been in some of the trailers, some of the major trailers, where she just makes the statement, I love God, God loves me, and I love my son. And so that's her journey. And that's where sometimes we have to start, is I don't know all the theological answers, but I know I love this person. And so we begin there at love. And I think that one of the things that we see in this movie is that love and God get such a bad rap. The ministry is called Love in Action, but there's just not a lot of love. I mean, yes, I think that everybody there sincerely thinks they're operating from a place of love, but I just had a real problem. You were talking about, you know, the emotions for you. The place in the movie that I lost it, there's a scene in there where the leader, his name is Victor Sykes. He makes the statement, God will not love you the way you are. And that broke my heart. I mean, because that's what I was told. I hear so many kids being told that. And that made me so sad as I was sitting there, knowing that that is the message. Whether it's said as bluntly as that, it still is the implied message that Absolutely. God will not love you the way you are.
I remember thinking when I was there how this truly was love in action. I really felt that this was love in action. I felt as the outreach director that when we went and we shared our ministry, that it was out of love, but I didn't feel at the time the desperation. I didn't feel the desperation that this absolutely had to work, that what we were doing was more about saving ourselves than it was saving other people. And I think that's the message that gets lost for Christians or people in any ideology that go on and they do things like that. It really is more self-centered than it feels at the time.
Yeah. And I think showing the fact that the mother just kept pushing, you had the two sides where inside the group during that 9 to 5, 8 to 5 during the day, whatever it was they were doing, their notebooks and all of that, they were repetitively being told, do not share anything outside this group. And yet the mother started pushing and she wanted to know. And I think that's very important because there is often a lot of secrecy that is not connected to the marketing materials. The marketing says, we're going to change you. We can fix you. You will be changed. And so you see that, but rarely do people try to push beyond that. How do you do it? What specifically will you be telling my child? Because as I've told people and I've written about, especially the parents, these places will tell you your child will be changed, but you may not like the change that ultimately happens. They may end up leaving the faith altogether. They may end up being emotionally scarred for life. They may end their life. And that's not the change that the conversion therapy program is going to tell you about.
Right. I have to say, Bill, one of the best articles that I've ever read of yours is How to Listen to an Ex-Gay Testimony. You just nail it on there where it's when you start talking to somebody who's been through conversion therapy, you hear them dancing around this word change, or they change the definition of change.
Yes.
And so it perpetuates this idea that people can actually change. And I know you get this. I've gotten emails saying, well, what about my cousin's brother's friend, Todd? He changed. He's an example of this. So they want to point to these anecdotal stories,
yes.
Which if you were to tear that down, if you were to go to Todd and you were to start asking these questions, you're going to find a very different story than the one they're telling you.
Yes. And that's what that article that I wrote grew out of, because I would talk about that there is no change in sexual orientation. These programs promise it, they don't deliver it. And inevitably, somebody would send me a link to a YouTube video, or they'd send me a VHS tape, or they'd, you know, do this. What about so-and-so? And so I saw these, I had listened to, I don't know, hundreds of these ex-gay testimonies and began to see these patterns. And so I wrote that of, I don't want to in any way dismiss somebody's personal experience, but I just simply say we need to listen carefully to what they're saying and what they're not saying.
Exactly.
Because I do think a lot of things change when you go into an ex-gay program. But again, it's just not the change they promise. What I see is there may be a change in behavior. You may act differently, like we saw in the movie where they're teaching the boys how to stand, how to shake hands, how to talk, and not to cross their legs a certain way. So there could be a change in behavior. There may be a change in vocabulary. We talk about, I'm gay. No, you're not gay. You have unwanted same-sex attractions. So they just change the vocabulary. So it's very, very deceptive. And that's the two things that I tell people. They are deceptive and they're damaging. And just those two elements should cause a parent to have serious doubts about sending their child.
I left the ministry in 90. 96 or 97. And all of these years later, there are times I don't know who I am. There are times where you think, what kind of person would I have been had I not gone through that organization? Or probably more importantly, had I not been so involved in evangelical Christianity for 25 years, you know, it changes you. It changes you forever. And it changes you to the point where you really don't know what you really feel. You don't know what reactions you're supposed to have or what reactions you would have if there wasn't this constant conservative filter running through your mind. You know, I've talked to Abel, you know, my husband, about my children, where I have two filters going through my head at all time. And when we have conversations about sexuality or social issues, I filter it twice. I filter it through that conservative evangelical ex-gay filter, and then I filter it through the psychological, you know, scientific filter of what is best for them as human beings, not what is best for them or how should they live as I would have lived back then.
Well, and I think that's one of the strong points of the book and the movie. The young man that wrote the book was in Love and Action for less than 2 weeks. And this and that had a lifelong impact on him. Think of people that were in it. I mean, I was obviously a slow learner. He got out before 2 weeks. I was in it for a couple of years.
Yeah, so 7 years for me.
And the people, I know people who were in it for 20 years. So yeah. Think of the damage that is prevalent. And I mean, almost. I don't even know the word that, how do we overcome that level, that intensity of indoctrination, of being told how horrible we are and, how much God can't love us that way for 7 years in your case, 2 or 3 years in my case, 15 or 20 years. It's a devastating, destructive, mindset. And I think that's why it's important that you look at this. And so the movie does present these elements. I do think that it presents some fictionalizations, over-dramatization, because as I said at the beginning, you and I know the person that is being depicted as the leader of this group. And I have actually talked with him one-on-one, and he tells me, no, a lot of that just did not happen.
No, he didn't.
And he is not that kind of person. And he's getting beat up online now. I saw a conversation that's one person had with him, one person who leads an ex-gay ministry, who said, you should be arrested and convicted for that kind of behavior. Well, number one, it didn't happen. But I think it's kind of a false outrage because this kind of stuff is happening, and this person who was criticizing my friend is an executive director of one of the largest groups in the country, and they do these kinds of things. Maybe they probably don't beat people over with the heads with a Bible, but it's still abuse of the soul. It is still religious abuse. And so why be outraged at the way a movie depicts something and not be outraged at the number of people who kill themselves? Because one of my best friends killed himself because of ex-gay teaching. So why not be outraged about that?
Well, it's, you know, it's deflection. I mean, I have to say personally, again, because this was, they named the ministry that I was a part of, and for better or for worse, that, you know, I made a lot of friends. I have friends to this day from that ministry, and I don't want to be associated with somebody getting literally beat up or, you know, called a fag as they did in the film.
Yes.
I don't want to be associated with that because I did that. None of that happened in our organization. At the same time, it's easy for us to excuse, oh, well, at least we didn't do that, when the reality is the damage does continue to be done simply by the ideologies that we keep proliferating with these types of organizations. So even though we didn't do that, we certainly did a lot of damage to people just going through it and just perpetuating these false ideologies. So, yes, so that makes me angry as well with that person who has specifically gone after him and whose organization is even further right than ours
was. Yeah, she is the executive director of one of the most evil. I'm not gonna yes. hedge words. It's evil.
Yes, hateful.
Evil organizations yes. out there. And they are it's just horrible. And yet she thinks that he should be arrested for something that was fictionalized in a movie. And that's why I think to me, one of the there was a scene in the movie toward the end, and I'm not gonna try to do a spoiler, so I'll do a spoiler alert here. But there is a scene where the young man just reaches this point. And again, I'm glad he did it before 2 weeks was over. But he's standing out there and this realization comes over him. I'm not going to tell the situation. But he just screams, fuck you. And then he looks up to the sky and screams, fuck you. And I do think that... I know that I came to that place. I didn't use those words, but I remember screaming out to God, I'm done. And in my mind, I'm done with God. I'm done with trying to change. I'm done with all of it. And I think that was so depictive of that place we have to reach in our lives where we just have to say, fuck this. This is not right. what I want for my life.
Right, right, right. And as you pointed out, it takes some people a lot longer than others.
Yeah, I'm a slow learner. It took me 3 years and a failed marriage. So, and losing my ministry. Walking away from my ministry, a ministry that I had built for 11 years, and walking away from my family because I was just, I was completely crumbling. And so it took a lot. And for others, they don't reach that point, and they end up as one of my friends did. He just ended his life because he couldn't reach that point. So again, I have my own issues with the movie, but I thought there were some strong elements to it, and so I can say, see it for yourself, decide for yourself.
Yeah, I would highly recommend this movie for anybody who has gone through conversion therapy, bring some tissues,
yeah.
or anybody who has considered putting your kid through conversion therapy or just doesn't know much about it. I mean, again, it's extreme examples, doesn't happen in most situations, but it does happen.
Yeah, there's other movies that have covered this. I mean, there was a movie about 8 or 10 years ago called Save Me with Chad Allen that was so, so well done. Very much more serious, but I thought it did a really good job. And one of my favorites is a small independent film that most people's never heard of called Fairhaven. It doesn't have the big Oscar winning names like this one does, but it showed conversion therapy in such a subtle, deceptive way that I was completely intrigued with the way they portrayed it. It just showed how malevolent it can be while appearing to be so caring and concerning.
All right. So let's wrap it up.
Thanks,
so,
brother.
Thank you. Hey, so have a great weekend. I know this is going to be, we're recording this on the weekend of the.
Yeah. We saw it on Friday. Today's Saturday, and I leave on vacation tomorrow.
All right. Well, have a great vacation, and we'll see everybody next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This special edition podcast was brought to you by Recovering from Religion. If you or someone you know has been affected by conversion therapy, we invite you to check out the resources available at BillPrickett.com or TimReimel.com, which can be found in the details section of this podcast. For more valuable resources or to make a donation to Recovering from Religion, go to RecoveringFromReligion.org or contact us at podcast@RecoveringFromReligion.org. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Recovering from Religion.